Hello, this is Finding Common Ground, Belfast Community Radio, WBFY 100.9 FM in Belfast, Maine. We are your hyper-local station, and we are streaming live at belfastcommunityradio.org. This is a call-in show, and you can call in at 338-2277. You can give us a call anytime. So we're here today with Bonnie Switerek, and Denise Pendleton of Literacy Volunteers, and they're here on the program to discuss poverty. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hello.
Nice to be here.
Yeah. So Bonnie, maybe we could start with you. Could you tell us about your work as a literacy volunteer? I assume you work one-on-one with people who can't read. Maybe you could give us an idea of what a session would look like.
I guess the easiest way to describe it is to say that there is not one single way that tutors work with a person. Because it is one-on-one, it's very tailored to whatever that person needs.
Do you go to their home?
No, not usually.
You meet at the library or something?
Yes, we meet at the library or we meet at a common space. And I've known some of the people that I tutor for such a long time that now they sometimes come to my house.
Oh.
So it's turned into kind of, a social thing as well as not just reading, you know. But everyone's needs are different, and some people really have to start right at the very basics, and other people just never really got good at reading, so they need help with, just getting better at it.
But. So, how does a person get to be an adult and not be able to read? They went through the public school.
That's a very good question, isn't it?
We don't have the answer to that.
That was one of the questions that I asked a gentleman who is, nearly at retirement age. And I said, how did you get to be this age and go through school and not learn to read? And it's a heartbreaking story. And I think it happens a lot, maybe more than we know, because people who can't read often hide that fact. And the people that love them help them hide that fact. But it's heartbreaking when you find that at one point in their lives, when they were in school, when we were all in school trying to learn to read, they were having trouble and just got pushed aside. And it's...
I've heard some of these people who can't read are really smart because, Denise, I wanted to talk with you. You're an award-winning educator, founder of Maine's Born to Read program, and have a graduate degree in literacy education. Maybe you can help us understand how somebody gets to be an adult and, how do they get through this world? How do you, maneuver through not being able to read the signs?
I would say that coming through our door of Literacy Volunteers, there's never been anyone who came through the door who could not read at all.
Oh.
The lowest level has probably been third grade or so, not comfortable reading restaurant menus at that level. But at that point, there's still a lot of decoding skills that have to happen. Another huge need is comprehension. So someone thinks they can read because they can read the sentence, they can read every word.
They can pronounce them.
They can pronounce the words, but they might read a few paragraphs or be studying for some sort of... we had somebody recently and they wanted to study for a test that you have to take if you're going to work in restaurant kitchens, actually, with any level of professionalism. As safety rules and just comprehension problems, the ability to read that, remember it, take a test on it. So there's a broad level of what reading is not. We're not actually, unlike the Born to Read program I ran, which was called Born to Read, and we are born to read, but it isn't easy. It doesn't come, it takes a lot of skills. Some children can teach themselves to read very easily at age 4, but not all. And and that's where the skill level needs support and development.
know, it's interesting when you talk about that age. My daughter, I felt like I taught my daughter how to read, you know, at home because, and, you know, I remember when she was going to the children's, Belfast Area Children's Center, Louisa was the woman who ran it then, and she said, don't teach your kid to read before school because they'll miss all the colors and shapes and, you know, because your eye goes directly to the words if you know them. And so it's better developmentally to hold off and teach them later.
Right. There are various opinions about that.
You don't agree?
Waldorf School doesn't believe in teaching kids to read until they're seven. No, I'm actually leaning in that direction because I think what happens is the focus is so much on reading. If it comes naturally, wonderful. But if it doesn't, there's such a focus on reading that children forget to play. And I'm a huge proponent of development of the imagination. And studies, a lot of studies have shown that if you just let them be whoever they are at age seven, they actually do learn to read much more quickly than if you're trying to teach them at five and they're not ready to read. So they're, you know, the theory is that the brain is really ready to learn to read at age seven, but not so ready at age five. That said, I am also a big believer in reading aloud to your children or having conversations or singing to your children because that does develop those skills that you need to read, phonemic awareness. So if you read to your children, that they develop that awareness of how language works. You know, and also comprehension skills.
I was dog sitting with this fellow's dog, and the dog was kind of agitated or whatever. Anyway, I started reading out loud. We do that in my house. And the dog just settled right down. It just got real quiet and looked at me. And later I asked the guy, do you read to your dog out loud? Oh, yes. He said, I read to my dog.
Well, the dog must be developing really good comprehension skills.
So tell us about Literacy Volunteers of Waldo County. How many volunteers are out there? I mean, are there dozens or one or two?
We have about 20, 25 active matches going on at any one time. An active match is one tutor with one adult learner. Some tutors have two adult learners, and that constitutes two matches. So it doesn't
like a mentoring thing?
It often... very often becomes mentoring. The matches vary from a student saying, I need help to pass the HISAT and I just need to meet with you for two sessions, to matches that go on for several years.
Like Bonnie was saying.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and then it becomes more social and also very much a mentor. And I think some of the adult learners that our tutors work with, it's really the core of the successful long-term relationship is the relationship it's all about the relationship. And once a relationship of trust is developed, then the learning can happen much more easily. And then the levels of learning grow deeper and deeper. There's the whole culture of literacy that it's a lot more than about learning how to read a sentence or even learning how to read a paragraph. It can be about having the conversation about a book that a lot of adults have never had before, or having a conversation about a paragraph you just read.
Interesting.
And the whole issue, if I might add, of trust, I think, is huge. Many of the people who didn't learn to read in school had very bad, very negative experiences and were shamed by their inability to read and then began to hide the fact that they couldn't read. And so just opening up and trusting that their tutor is someone that they can trust, I think makes a huge difference. Like Denise said, she's a very big believer in the importance of the relationship to the learning process. And I think most of us can relate to the fact that if we don't feel comfortable, we don't comprehend. A lot of people, I know myself, if I go to the doctor and the doctor has anything serious to say, my hearing goes, you know. It's you know, and so I think trust and being able to open up with a person allows them to be able to learn.
Do you often or does it happen that the mentor is actually younger than the, what do you call it, the student? Or they're just various ages? Is usually one.
It seems to vary all over the place. I tutor one person who's, you know, younger than my son, and I tutor another person who's almost my age.
It's all over the place.
The ages do seem, it's from 18 on, right?
We tutor, sometimes they're as young as 17 because they're in the adult ed program working on a high SAT or high school diploma even at age 17. But typically, right now, our matches, I think, are ages 19 to 72. And we also are tutoring not just in reading, but writing goes along with it, of course, but also in math and development of computer skills.
Oh, really?
And we actually have quite a few math students come through the door, students who are trying to pass their math component of their HiSET, which is the new GED.
That's a kind of a language, too, math, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
I don't think of it that way, but
yeah.
I think I could stretch my mind to think of that way. Mm-hmm. I heard once that it takes a child 2 weeks to learn to read if they're really focused and want to learn. Is that true?
I've never heard that, and that seems a pretty outrageous statement. But
yeah, it was in a book about education, said that, you know, so much time is spent, but if because the kids really aren't motivated. And if they were really wanting to learn, if you have a motivated learner really wants to learn it, can they learn it really fast?
Well, I think that presupposes, so let's say you have a seven-year-old and you've read aloud to that child and you've sung to that child. And as you read aloud to the child, you sometimes pointed to the words and talked about the letters and what it sounds like. And
they're prepped and ready.
Just provided that child with an environment of print and language, rich language, then when they're seven, they probably will just, they just pick up a book and instantly they're reading. So it's all about what happens before that.
Okay. Admitting that you can't read must take a lot of courage.
It does. And I often tell people when they come through the door how much I admire them, because I think it takes a lot of courage, and I do think one of the greatest barriers, statistics are 1 in 13 residents of Waldo County lack basic literacy skills.
No.
That means the ability to complete a driver's license test, complete a job application, read the help wanted, go to a restaurant and read the menu.
Read the drug prescriptions.
And this is a continuing thing, not like these are older people or younger people just coming out of school. This is
adults.
Ongoing.
1 in 13 adults. That said, they are not pouring through our doors. And I think I've thought a lot about why this is the case. And it's the greatest challenge of my work, I think, is to figure out how to reach those people and provide them with services. One is that they've learned to adapt. Two is that their lives are mired in the chaos of poverty. Multiple jobs, just trying to survive. Another huge one is shame, which you have touched on.
You are anticipating my questions because I have a lot on that. We're going to be talking about poverty. I want to remind the listeners that this is Finding Common Ground, and Jennifer Hill here talking with Bonnie Switerek. Close enough?
Switerek.
Switerek. Yes. Switerek. Maybe by the third time I say this, I'll get it right. Switerek. And Denise Pendleton of Literacy Volunteers. And we're here to talk about poverty. We've kind of led off talking about the Literacy Volunteers. You both work through that organization in Waldo County. Wikipedia, in defining poverty, breaks it down into two categories, absolute and relative, where absolute, you can't meet the basic needs for food, clothing, and shelter, and relative, varying from country to country. Are there people living in Waldo County in absolute poverty?
Well, remind me of what absolute poverty is again. Your listeners might want to hear it too.
Absolute, they can't meet the basic needs for food, clothing, and shelter. That is to say, they're, you know, in some kind of agony there. They can't they don't have clothes or food or shelter that they can.
You could talk about the health nurse and what she had to say.
Yes, we are looking to partner more and more with public health and Waldo County General Hospital in outreach.
Public health nurse.
And I've been chatting with Susan Dupler Young, who's our public health nurse, who's doing amazing work, and hearing her talk about the people she serves, that there were two Waldo County residents who have been living in tents for a couple years.
Year round.
And there were five people who are homeless this winter who occasionally were couch surfing, but sometimes sleeping in hallways or in the police station. So there are those incidents, and she's got her finger on the pulse of some of those, you know, community members, residents of Waldo County who are living that way. We know that in our public schools, there are children coming to school, and the only time they eat is when they're at school, and there's a meal served to them through the school, which is...
What do they do in the summer?
Pretty telling. There are school programs, summer school programs, that are created in part to make sure those meals are being served. There are cuts being made to those programs all the time. In fact, I think this summer there was a cut to the program so that... in fact, Susan was talking about this. What do you do in the month of August when those programs are cut off? So she's got some sort of initiative going to make sure food is going to those families.
Are people starving here?
Waldo County, not Waldo County, but Maine is the third highest rate of food insecurity in the nation, behind Louisiana and Alabama.
Wow. That's horrendous.
Indeed. So poverty, as I said, if you're living in poverty, there tends to be a correlation between poverty and low education levels. One student we have, who is in his 50s, I'm guessing, dropped out of school when he was in 8th grade because the family was in such poverty they needed him to go get a job and bring money into the family.
What did he do?
That was back in the day of the poultry plants, and he worked in the poultry plant.
Wow. It's just mind-boggling to me. I mean, when we're talking about absolute poverty.
So, Jennifer, can I mention that when you mentioned absolute poverty, it made me think of some information that I've gotten about types of poverty, and this initially came from a book called See Poverty, Be the Difference, that I became very interested in through Literacy Volunteers and just through an article that I read by Donna Beagle, and she's the author of this book. I highly recommend it. It's not a new book. It was published in 2007. But the ideas are still the same. And she talks about generational poverty, temporary or situational poverty, for instance, like the depression or immigrants in poverty, and then working poverty. So those are three different kinds of poverty, and I'm sure that there's some overlap. You know, there are people who have been in generational poverty where their parents lived in poverty, where they've never owned their own property. They all they know is poverty, and their grandparents and their parents, and they learn lessons that poverty teaches them, and they're not good lessons, and they learn.
What would be a lesson?
I think the poverty teaches them that somehow it's their fault because our society treats them like it's their fault. So they internalize that, and they have very different attitudes because of growing up in poverty. They also learn to be very innovative and take care of a lot of things. They have a lot of skills and talents that might go unrecognized. I think we need to look at those.
I was going to, one of the comments I had was that there's a sub-economy where people, you know, they trade, grow, and put up their own food and cut their own hair and cut their own wood. Some people live on campers and on other people's land. I was wondering, is that more relational poverty, where they're not starving, not physically uncomfortable because they're working it out here on the sub-economy? Do you see that, Bindi?
That's
you
my
look so much
name.
Like your sister. Sorry.
I see a lot of resourcefulness, and I do admire a lot of what the stories I hear and a lot of what I witness in the adult learners we work with. A lot of resourcefulness and resilience. Something that Donna Beagle puts out in a workshop is a worksheet called Hidden Rules of Class. But what it really is, it's a list of what. If you know all these items, it's about could you survive in poverty, and it really is an indicator of how much what you need to know to survive in poverty. I'll just read a few of them,
sure.
If you don't mind.
Yeah, no.
I know which churches and sections of town have the best rummage sales. I know which rummage sales have bag sales and when. I know how to get someone out of jail. I know how to physically fight and defend myself. I know how to keep my clothes from being stolen at the laundromat. I know what problems to look for in a used car. I know how to live without a checking account. I know how to live without electricity and a phone. I know how to use a knife as scissors. I know how to move in half a day. I am very good at trading and bartering. I can get by without a car. I know what to do when I don't have money to pay the bills. So when you read that, you think, I don't think I would know any of these things, and what skills it takes, and adaptability and strength and resilience and resourcefulness to be able to stay on top of keeping your life going when you don't have the resources others of us have.
Well, it's interesting. Life is full of trade-offs, and you can stockpile a great deal of money and lose out on the simple pleasures. Is there a benefit to poverty? That's a radical question.
That is a radical question.
When I grow up.
I think that I don't think I'm qualified to answer that question. I think you'd have to ask someone living in poverty if they think there's a benefit to poverty.
Well, maybe we could talk a little about relational poverty because, you know, these people who are resourceful enough to, you know, manage to keep themselves above that suffering level by hook or crook working in that sub-economy. I just wonder if those people, I mean, imagine that person working to survive and another person who's doesn't have that gift of, you know, maybe as a, has been given a trust fund and gets money every month coming in, are they missing out somehow on some of this adventurous life of, go ahead.
I Hello? Don't feel that they are missing out. And
okay, just a moment.
I think it's interesting to hear in the reading I've been doing of in our book group about poverty, that one richness to the lives of those in poverty is their relationships that they care of. Their friendships in their family relationships are very strong and mean so much to them, and they will sacrifice a great deal. If they only eat one meal a day, they will share it with four people who also don't have one meal. So that spirit of generosity and friendship and community is very strong. That said, I don't think any of these people would choose to be in that situation of poverty. There's no reason why you can't have that richness and not live in poverty.
There's a lot of isolation going on, though, at the other end of the line. I mean, the scale, mm-hmm. higher up.
Mm-hmm.
We have a caller. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, this is a very interesting discussion, and I just wanted to have a comment here. My thoughts on poverty is that it's much better to have a life where you start off in poverty and work your way into a wealthier lifestyle than, and the worst would be to start off in a very wealthy situation.
Go the other way.
Way into poverty.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, thank
but it's
you.
Very interesting discussion. I enjoy listening to it, and I'll go back to listening. Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. Did you want to comment on that? Or
I would agree. It's hard to get those skills later in life if you've been spoon-fed or had, if you're used to things being given to you in a certain way, and you have, it's all, a lot of it's about expectations. And you, it's got to be like being thrown off a boat and suddenly learning to swim when you've never known how to swim. But yes, again, speaking to the incredible skills, I have a student in adult ed who's just turned 18. He's been working since he was 14, a number of odd jobs, and he's had some rough times, but he's gotten his feet on the ground, and he's got a focus, and he's going to get his high school diploma, and he's been kicked out of school a number of times, but adult ed is working very well for him, where he's getting a lot of attention, and he's very focused on his studies. He's going to become an electrician, and but he's got a lot of resourcefulness that will get him far in life.
You both are leading a book group on poverty, and the book group is discussing a lot of books that people have written on the topic. Thinking about the pride that comes with survival when you're subject to that level of, you know, as you said in the list, you know, knowing where the sales are, knowing when the, you know, do you find that certain kind of pride to, do you run into people who are defeated who just say, oh, geez, you know, my life is miserable? Or do you run into a lot of times people, or maybe both, people say, you know, I'm doing okay. You know, I'm making it. I know where those sales are, and I know when the bag sale is, and I'm going to be there, and I'm living this life and feeling good about it.
I would say that I don't see that so much, no. I'm thinking of one student in particular who has a life that's really hard. He doesn't have running water. He has a hard time coming into being tutored and being clean. He is really run over by life. And I think the relationship with his tutor is one of the highest points of his life. Mm-hmm. And they meet twice a week. And his reading skills are developing. And they have fascinating conversations around what they are reading. He's trying to get a job in maybe
be
a commercial driver's license test. He's had numerous accidents where his feet are in chronic pain. He's having trouble getting medical care. But he gets himself in there to be tutored twice a week.
His mind's on fire with it. I just want to say that this is Belfast Community Radio, WBFY 100.9 FM, Belfast, Maine. We are streaming live at BelfastCommunityRadio.org, and you can call the number 338-2277 with any comments or questions. Were you going to say something, Bonnie?
I was, but I forgot.
That's okay.
I would just say, you know, you talk about pride. Now, one of the books we have read in our book group is Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America by Linda Tirado. This is a book that's full of fierce anger. And she, no, you know, really right out on screech anger. So do you think you detected pride in this book when you read it, Bonnie?
I do think that she had, yeah, I think she had some kind of pride, but
I picked up on that too.
Yeah, there was pride, but it was mixed with anger. And I do think that there's a certain pride that anyone has in their ability to survive. But It has to be so mixed with, if you're fighting for survival, and I don't think a lot of us can really even understand that, that fight for survival, when you don't know where your next meal is coming from or how you're going to keep your family warm.
And if it's generational, you got no backup.
Right, right.
One point that I think a lot about in life in general, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Malcolm Gladwell in the Outliers Club, but it's the story of what makes people successful. And he through some research, he's identified that luck is one of the three essential components, the other being talent and practice. And he studies hockey players and why they're so good, and violinists, and why did Bill Gates get to where he is? Well, he happened to go to a school where there are computers, and he happened to have lots of time to spend on the computers, and he also had the talent, but he also could put in a zillion hours, but he also had the luck of the computers being in the school where he was. So I think a lot about how luck is a factor in whether or not somebody is in poverty or not. And Linda Tirado talks about that in her book, Hand to Mouth, and she was lucky in that she happened to be writing a response to a blog, and her response went viral, and it turned into this book.
Why did it go viral?
Luck.
luck. It was she was just right on Screech, and it seemed to hit a chord with people that this is.
What do you think that chord was? Because
it was about the outrageousness of her life, and the question she was answering in this blog is, why do poor people do things that seem so self-destructive? And that infuriated her as she, and the story, her, this sort of semi-memoir is of what her life was like in marrying, of all things. The man she married was a Air Force veteran, right? And it just dumbfounds me that they were still scrounging for money. I thought if you were, you know, had been in the military, you would be taken care of. And how she had two or three jobs at a time and what that was like. And if you were, if you were trying to schedule your hours and you had two part-time jobs, it was impossible because they don't give you a schedule for the month. And stories like that I hadn't really thought about how hard it is to live at that level, and you have two or three different part-time jobs, and how it is to put those together, and what if your car breaks down. She recounts the story of walking for miles. What was that? She had to walk 4 miles to get to her two jobs every single day.
There was another book also on poverty in America and how it's sort of hidden somehow. I'm in this book group. I'll out myself right now, and I'm trying to remember the name of that book. it's how it doesn't. It doesn't look like the poverty you think of in terms of.
Well, the American way of poverty.
Yes, the
how
American.
The other half still lives.
Yes,
Sasha Abramski.
That's the one. That was an interesting book.
He was not as angry.
No, he was more academic.
Yes.
But it was interesting that you don't think of it. Like you say, oh, Africa's a poor country. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, the United States is a rich country. But then there are pockets all through there that are, you know.
Yeah,
the extreme that was a really good book.
Poverty. Yes.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about this workshop you both went to. I think you've been to several of her workshops. You mentioned Dr. Donna Beagle. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me what makes her workshops? What you got out of that?
I found her to be a very good presenter. She tells a lot of stories. That's her style of teaching.
What did you take from it?
She's very forgiving and very kind, even though she hasn't always been treated
is she
kindly.
Poor?
She was. She grew up in generational poverty, and
became a doctor.
Yes. And now she's trying to help other people become what she calls poverty informed, because she believes that most of us don't really understand what it's like to be living in the war zone of poverty. It's one of the expressions she uses, and that it's a fight for survival. And she also thinks that some of the people who actually need to become more informed about poverty are those living in poverty, because many of them actually buy into the stereotypes. And one of the biggest things I took away from her seminar was the exercise that we did to examine our own biases. You know, everyone has biases. We all do. We like to think that we're not biased, but we all are. And sometimes we don't even realize the bias that we have.
What did you find? Do you remember?
Well, we sat at a table and we made a list of different kinds of things that we might be biased about that might prevent us from communicating with someone who is living in poverty.
Like maybe they don't smell so good.
Exactly. Or they don't, they don't have all their teeth. Or yeah. They have tattoos up and down their arms. Or they, are buying frivolous things when they should be buying, We all think we know.
How many of us judge, people smoking cigarettes?
Yes.
And we think, why are you smoking cigarettes? Mm-hmm. Or all the horror about what people are spending mm-hmm. food stamps on. And Linda mm-hmm. Tirado, again, in her book, is just, we all deserve a break. We mm-hmm. all deserve a way to indulge ourselves in the moment. And why would we be saving, $10 a month when that amounts to $240 a year, when it might be the one pleasure we have to recover mm-hmm. from all the mm-hmm. stresses of living in poverty? And that cigarette smoking is something you do when you've got nothing else really that you can count on. And it also is a way to medicate yourself keep yourself going when you've got three part-time jobs. And
pretty traumatic facing the big void there.
And we all do make judgments about others. I mean, we make judgments
about...
You
can't help it.
That's right. About people in different political parties than we are affiliated with, or people who are wealthy or people who are poor. So those biases make it very difficult to communicate with another person.
Now, Denise, does she talk about class much, this Donna Beagle? Is that a big part of the workshop?
Well, she does. What I read to you earlier, as I said, was a handout from her class about class and the class differences. An interesting feature of her workshop, and it's talked a lot about in the other book we were just reading for our book group right now, Hillbilly Elegy, but the idea of social capital. And so you might go into, Donna Beagle recounts this story about herself, who she grew up in deep poverty. She dropped out of school, had a child or two by the time she was 19, was divorced. But she found her way, thankfully, for a good teacher in community college and some government programs that allowed her to do those, take that
right.
class. That no longer exist. But at any rate, she found herself out of poverty. She was having a meal with some other scholars or something like that. I'm turning to Bonnie. Correct me if I'm wrong. But she found that she didn't know how to eat the meal. She didn't know what to do with all the silverware on the table. And I think the big part of it was she sat down. I think it was self-serve. She sat down. She immediately started to eat. And then she stopped eating and looked around her and noticed nobody else was eating. Because she realized they were all waiting for the keynote speaker to sit down and start or something like that. And she felt really embarrassed. She had no idea that was... But those are the rules of different classes. And J.D. Vance in Hillbilly Elegy talks... That's a huge theme of his at the end of his book, that when he went to Yale Law School, but he had no idea how to function in the...
There are a lot of rules. Middle class have a lot of rules.
Unspoken
they
rules.
Are middle class rules, yeah. And the schools are full of them.
Middle
and,
class, yeah.
And if you don't know them, you can learn them,
Yeah, you can. poverty is isolating. When you don't have transportation, when you don't have money to pay to attend a public event, the alternative, what, just stay home? Reading and writing can be expansive and help with mental health, I would think. Making, you know, you feel like more of a part of things. You learn a lot through books, too, about how to do things. TV, too. This can help with isolation, at least making you feel like you're a part of things, even if you're watching the television and enjoying other people's drama. So how do you counteract this isolation? Do you have ideas about how to do that? Is the
It's a huge problem in rural areas, and a lot of the poverty that exists in Maine is in rural areas, and transportation is a big problem.
It is. I started to list the biggest barriers to students coming through our door, whether it's to be tutored with literacy volunteers or to attend adult ed classes. But, you know, it's shame and it's the chaos of poverty and multiple jobs. But transportation is a huge issue. And I know Waldo Kapp has a committee and they're trying to work on it. But it's rural transportation is a challenge, unlike urban, you know, transportation where you can have buses going around a designated area. But I had a student I was wanting to, who called me, and she was trying to take classes at Mount View, and she lived in Troy, I think, or Thorndike, and she was riding her bike, and it was at night, and it was winter. It wasn't working for her. So we thought if you could get into Belfast with public transportation and it's daytime classes, maybe that would work. But it took me, I would say, almost a year to figure out how to get the transportation for her, because she has to be income eligible. She had to get certain paperwork. It took quite a long time.
It seems like there would be people who would be interested. You know, I know there are people delivering meals to people, shut-ins. But it's like there'd be people who have access to transportation who would be willing to help people work through the literacy if you could get an arm that was doing transportation. I don't know.
We've thought about that. Yeah. I've had some volunteers say, and we've actually had some volunteers help us just do that, just help us with some transportation issues, because that does come up.
It's interesting that you don't go into their homes, though. Or at least you said you don't.
Those are not expectations that you go into the home of an adult learner, and it often is, there's too much going on in their home for them to really focus on learning, and it seems that it's good for them to actually come into a setting that's a little different and a little more formal.
Mm-hmm. So shame is a driver for all sorts of problems like domestic abuse and drug addiction. Shaming people because they can't meet their needs doesn't take their situation to an account. Have you guys got ideas about how to counteract that shame that goes on? I mean, it's a systemic issue in the culture, the shaming.
I think building relationships, building partnerships that allow you to build those relationships. We've been using a slightly different name for our website and connecting literacy volunteers to the our website is www.waldoreads, because we wanted it to be sort of a more inclusive thing as opposed to literacy volunteers. I think that
interesting.
I think there are individuals who feel like literacy is automatically means you can't read, whereas Waldo Reads just seems slightly more inclusive. Mm-hmm. So,
well, if you've got 20 volunteers, or how long has this organization been around?
It has been around for about 32 years.
Wow.
And it started as a standalone nonprofit, and it survived that way for quite a long time. When the 501c3 dissolved, it was with Broadreach for a while, and then when they felt they couldn't keep it going, they asked Adult Ed to take it on. So it's been at Belfast Adult Ed for about 4 years.
So if people want to volunteer and to be a literacy volunteer, How do they get a hold of you? I mean, so they could actually go to adult ed and sit maybe in a classroom. Is that, or is it usually at the library? How does it happen?
Well, if someone wants to be a volunteer, they would call Belfast Adult Ed or email me.
Can you give that?
The email is dpendleton@rsu71.org. Belfast Adult Ed is 338-3197. I have just completed a 4-session training for new volunteers.
Oh.
And I had actually had a pretty phenomenal turnout of 10 to 12 people for that. And the challenge really is outreach to those who would like to, who could benefit from the services of these volunteers. So I really need volunteers who want to help out with outreach and developing partnerships in some really
maybe transportation,
really creative ways, or providing transportation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it's an exciting idea. On our walks around town, Marshall and I noticed little boxes of books on posts and enjoyed some really good reads from those. And we were wondering how many little libraries there are in Maine. Is that part of your group?
Yes, literacy. We had a literacy volunteer who was talking about all the books she has and how she doesn't know what to do with them. And I think I had just been reading about the Little Free Libraries initiative that started in Wisconsin. And it's around the nation now. There are these little free libraries on street corners. And so we started putting some of them up.
That was just in Belfast then?
In Waldo. Well, we'd like to. We're Waldo County, so we are hoping to get one up in Brooks. We have one on Sears Island. We have about, how many up, Bonnie?
I don't know. I think 6 or 8.
Maybe 8.
How do you arrange for that? Because we want to have one on our property. The trail for the Hills to Sea trail goes through our property, and we thought it would be really cool to have a little one there.
Yes. Well, you want to think about how many people are going past that particular spot, and we'll have books. You don't want it to be in the woods where someone would have to lug 5 books in and 5 books out. But one of our most popular locations is Swan Lake Grocery. So that's a great spot because people are just going to go there and park and go into the store. We have one on Bridge Street that's pretty active and popular, but anyone can put one up anywhere. We have had several people in town call us up and say, can I put one up on the foot of my driveway? And anyone can do that. They don't have to ask for our permission. Yeah.
And you can get free books at the YMCA. So
yes, that's a form of the little free library for sure. And the beauty of them is that it just helps promote, I think, reading, a culture of reading, and having books readily available and not during certain hours or in the Belfast Free Library, which is a great resource, but they are limited in what they can offer.
The consumer society in which we all live tells us possessions determine how valuable we are. And that's a kind of a systemic message that comes to us in our culture, and kind of seeing through that and seeing the value of each of us as human beings would be a good idea. Just how do we do that? Like you said, acknowledging, Bonnie, you were acknowledging your judgments.
Yes, and I think that this radio program is one of the ways that we can start to get the word out to people, get people thinking about it. You know, I talk to people and I say, well, I'm trying to learn about poverty, which is really what I'm trying to do. And trying to understand what it's like for the people living in poverty. And I prefer to say people living in poverty than to say poor people. I think there's a little subtle distinction there, and I think that's important. They are people, and they have a lot to offer, and I want to learn more about it. But I think our society, as you mentioned, it sends a lot of messages through movies and, you know, and the same thing happened with race relations. It had to be brought out, brought to the forefront of the public eye before changes would be made. And I think we all need to learn more about it.
We are on the front edge of that movement right here today. I want to thank you both so much for being here today. Bonnie Switerick.
Yes.
And Denise Pendleton. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Jennifer, for having us.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Great. So just want to remind listeners that tonight at 6 o'clock at the Boathouse, Maine All Care will be having its spring launch party. This is a free event, so everybody can come. And we're going to be spending the first hour listening to the Belfast Fiddlers and enjoying local beer from Three Tides. And there'll be wine, and there'll be refreshments, all kinds of food. And then we're going to play Healthcare Jeopardy. We have prizes from local merchants. And the whole thing will culminate in a movie. And the chair of the board of Maine All Care is going to be there. And he's going to be leading a discussion after the movie. He's from Lewiston. He's an emergency room physician. I can't pronounce his name or I would tell you. But he's going to be there. So you're all invited, and hope you come out. And next week on the program, we are going to be having Bevelin Betty. And she is running for the Maine House of Representatives from Belfast and Waldo and I think Northport on the Republican ticket. So tune in next week. And in the meantime, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you then. Bye.